Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Big Bang Intrationism podcast. This week, we're going to do an interview with Tom Brigman. I have Tom Brigman with me on the line.
Bridgman.
Oh, sorry about that.
B-R-I-D-G, yes, it's, yeah, I know.
I can't pronounce things very well.
The spelling does look a little weird.
All right.
But it's Bridgman, like the 1946 Nobel Prize winner in physics.
Oh, I
should have known
that.
But I don't think I'm any relation to.
So, Tom Brigman, we have with us on the line, and I guess we'll let Tom Brigman introduce himself and what he plans to be talking about with us this evening. So, Tom, take it away.
Okay. Well, thanks, Robert. I am a physicist by training. Now I'm kind of fumbling because I didn't expect to be doing a full intro like this. I expected to be fielding questions a little bit more. My background is I'm a physicist by training. I was a graduate student at Clemson University, got a master's and doctorate at Clemson, working with the nuclear astrophysics group there, specializing in the study of both supernova remnants during my master's degree and black hole accretion physics and high time resolution studies from gamma rays from black holes, particularly Cygnus X1 at the time. I got started in creationism, studying creationism. Well, technically, I guess I could say I got started in creationism back when I was in high school. I was a member of a Christian fundamentalist group was in South Florida, where I lived at the time. And this was kind of my first exposure to creationism. I was attending this group, and they were talking about a presentation about someone who was basically critical of the theory of evolution, and they presented the kind of things that you still sometimes hear in spite of the number of times they've been debunked, like flowers can't live for a very long period of time without just say one species of flower and stuff like that. It's kind of the same argument they're using with irreducible complexity today, where the thing just won't work if you just have one, or if you don't have at least two things for some of the reproductive issues.
Yeah, just rehashes of old creationist arguments.
Yeah, and this was in 1972, 73, thereabouts. I was in around 9th or 10th grade, I think, was the time. So at the time, I was also growing very strong in my scientific understanding as well. I was reading an incredible amount of stuff and learning how these fancy little equations, you could actually do stuff with them, which was really kind of cool. I remember one book on quantum electronics that kind of started from the Schrodinger equation and went into the derivation of like how matter works, and then how semiconductors work, and finally you're getting these equations, that electronic engineers use today. And the electronic engineer, they see it, it's like 47.7 times the voltage and divided by the current is equal to, your bias voltage or something like that. But the engineering books would have this arbitrary constant. You didn't know where this number came from. The physics books showed you where the number came from, which I thought was very cool. So, it was always, some combination of Planck's constant and electric charge and Boltzmann's constant or something like that. And it was just really fascinating. So the creationism exposure at that time never really stuck. I've had various falling in and falling out with organized religion. I have a religious faith of my own. I regard myself as a Christian. I'm just a little disturbed by a number of the,
fundamentalist groups?
Fundamentalist Christians, but also some of the, maybe the term is celebrity Christian, which I've heard found, the ones that get a lot of press about their alleged Christianity. Mm-hmm. So I've had various involvements back and forth with them over the years in that regard. I've been satisfied and dissatisfied with, kind of moved from churches, both as a result of my moving and as a result of just general dissatisfaction with a particular congregation. But anyway, I went off to school. I wound up having a little round of time where I was working in business for a number of years and finally went back to school in physics. And when I was in grad school, we had Robert Gentry, who some may be familiar with, proposes that these little halos in granite are evidence of the instantaneous creation of the Earth. And because his main argument being that while there are these halos created by the alpha decays around uranium and thorium, and these are no problem for the Earth being old, there are also halos around isotopes of polonium, which have half-lives of like 3 days and less. So his argument was that, well, the granite couldn't form and solidify in 3 days. So the only way these polonium halos could have been in there was if the granite instantaneously formed around the polonium and then the polonium decayed. And I went to, I was in grad school at the time, and I had one of these big new chart of the nuclides up on my wall. I can't remember whether it was in office or home, but I remember one evening shortly after the talk, looking at it and saying, well, wait a minute, where does polonium come from? And I thought, well, it's up there, it's an alpha decayer. And it's probably a result from alpha decay from something, because that alphas tend to be very dominant up in that region of the chart. And I looked up there and I looked at the chart and I saw polonium and I said, okay, well, I got to go two protons over and two neutrons over. And there was the gas radon. And all of his polonium isotopes all had potential radon precursors. And radon, a lot of people may know, and I'm not sure if it's true in your area of the country, but in this area of the country, there are people that have radon removal systems in the basements, because radon, being a very heavy gas, tends to settle in low-lying areas. It's percolating through the rock, through the granite, due to all this radioactive decay, and it settles in low-lying areas like basements and such. And it's actually a radiological hazard. It has a fairly short half-life. It's an alpha emitter. If you breathe it in, it decays right in your lungs. You can't really get rid of it. But suppose this gas doesn't make it out of the rocks. What happens to the radon that gets trapped in the rocks? Well, if it gets trapped as, say, a small bubble or something like that, it's going to leave this artifact of pure polonium, looking like the starting point of the decay. And it was one of those things, just like flash of insight, like, oh gosh. And I felt so cheated. I went to this guy's show, and he and his son were actually doing the presentation. I remember feeling so cheated by that. I was like, oh golly, and I didn't recall him mentioning it at all in the presentation, which
Just kind
also
of.
was kind of annoying too. It was very weird that some of the constraints he put on, like, you had to submit your questions in writing and stuff like that. So I didn't really I we wound up I was there with a couple of other grad students, and on the way out we ran into Gentry departing, and I got a chance to briefly ask a question. And he pointed out that no, the polonium, it's got to be pure in there, because that's the only there you don't there's no residual of anything prior. So that was how I first realized that, gee, some of this stuff is really wrong, and it's kind of obvious that it's wrong.
They just use the
And it,
arguments anyway, yeah.
yeah, and but this guy's going around the country doing these presentations. So that kind of sat and it kind of stewed a little bit. I started following the Talk Origins news group and stuff like that. And a little bit later, when I moved into my current area, I wound up working with a local astronomy club. And one time, I think it was like March of 1998, I got this email from the guy who was the sort of the guy who maintained worked at the facility where the club met. It was a public school facility, and they had been getting emails from a local creationist claiming that because they were a state institution under equal time or something like that, the school system had to allow him to present his version of young cosmos creationism at the astronomy club. And they put me on this thing. I was the president of the club at the time, actually. I think I was had just become no okay I think I'd been president for a year or so at the time. And I listened to some of this guy's stuff, and I said, well, wait a minute. And I went and I did a little bit of research, and I responded back to him saying, well, if what you say is true, then there's this and this and this, which just doesn't match up. And this went on back and forth for quite some time. And eventually the guy, we actually at one point thought about a way in which we could have him present at the club, and I had put together enough resources at the time that I thought that, I could do like a follow-up presentation something like that, where like he might present and I might present, or something of that nature. And he kind of disappeared for a while. He showed up again a couple of years later, actually, bringing up rehashing some of the same old stuff,
Hoping you forgot.
well, I had actually started getting into the issue of the stuff. I started with Barry Setterfield's claims of decaying speed of light, and found that, well, gee, I found that some people had actually looked at some of these issues. And of course, the nice thing about science is that because you know what most of the physics is, and the mathematical rules are very well defined, if someone describes something to you, very often, if you know the starting assumptions that they had, very often you can do it yourself. That's another really powerful thing about science, is that Galileo, he built a telescope based on someone's description of how one of these things worked. So that was the nice thing. He knew about optics, and he played with lenses and stuff like that. So the nice thing is about having this sort of like absolute way that things work is that if you understand the basic assumptions, then very often you can reproduce the work, which is important in science. You have to have reproducibility.
I guess, could you briefly describe what it is that we're going to be discussing today?
Okay, well, the one of the aspects of this project that I thought was particularly fascinating is a lot of people think of topics like astronomy as happening way out there, that it's not something that you can get your hands on Earth. And this ties back to the whole notion of the ideas of extrapolation. Creationists like to argue that, well, there's these gaps in the fossil record, or that you take these little microevolution changes and turn them into, quote, macroevolution, unquote, and you can't test that kind of stuff. But one thing I've found, and I'll admit I have a physics and astronomy bias in this, but I'm sure that others in biology and geology could probably find very similar analogies, and hope that that some of them hear this and do actually explore some of these possibilities, is that there's loads of things that we can make these extrapolations of our principles on Earth, that we know on Earth, out into space. And we very often see that a lot of stuff matches up with what we expect to see. But every once in a while, we might notice a discrepancy. And sometimes we can actually, those discrepancies cue us into new phenomenon that we can then test on Earth. And that has actually happened a surprisingly large number of times in the history of physics, especially in the 20th century. One of the things, the most fascinating stories that I heard from my advisor in his nuclear astrophysics class was the story of, in the mid-1950s, Fred Hoyle was studying nucleosynthesis in stars. Now, Fred Hoyle was no fan of the Big Bang. He had his own steady-state cosmology, but they both had a similar type problem in the sense that they both started with hydrogen, or maybe a little bit of helium. And they had to be able to build the heavier elements from some way to make elements for humans and planets and stuff like that. And so he said, well, about the only pl other place this could happen is in stars and the nuclear reactions in stars. And it had already been established a little bit, and I might talk about it a little bit more later, back in the 1930s, that it was nuclear reactions that powered stars. And Hoyle ran into this problem where, when he used these what we knew about nuclear physics at the day, and tried to calculate how these abundances would be produced in the stars of elements like oxygen and carbon and heavier elements, because he would build them up. He'd look at the nuclear reactions like, okay, well, you can have a helium maybe catch a proton or something like that. They kept building stuff up based on the existing elements around them, and they would at certain temperatures, the reactions would be very favorable for these reactions to go. And one thing Hoyle ran into a problem when he did these calculations is he found out that, well, there's very little, he gets got very little amounts of carbon and oxygen out of the nuclear reactions. And it was far smaller than the amount that we were measuring in the sun, which we regarded as fairly, at the time, as a fairly almost primordial type composition, or at least younger than the Earth, or older than the Earth, I'm sorry. So one thing he tried to figure a way out of this problem. Now, if creationists of the day, and I wish I'm wondering if there was actually anything like this, but the problem apparently didn't last very long. But the creationists of the day would have said, "Ah, this is proof that we were not created by stars, that these elements must have been created instantaneously some way or something like that." But Hoyle wasn't going to give up that easily, and he took a little bit of a guess, and he said, "Well, maybe there's a resonance in the carbon nucleus, a kind of a favored state where if helium combines together to form beryllium and then it lasts just long enough for a third helium nucleus to come in, that it will go into an it will make an energy a carbon nucleus in an energy state such that the carbon will hang around a while and be able to radiate the excess energy and become a stable carbon atom." And then that would, help also pass on the higher, because the carbon reaction would be considerably more favored, you'd get more carbon out of the reaction. And that would make more carbon so that and the next alpha particle could come along and make oxygen and the like. And so he went back to the calculations and he said, "Okay, well, let me see what happens if I put a resonance in carbon." And he plugs this resonance in and plays around with the numerical values of what energy level it had to be at to make the amount of carbon that we observed in the universe, or in the sun at the time. And he found an energy, he found it at an energy of about 7.6 million electron volts. And so he said, "Well, okay," and he knew a lot of people at the Kellogg Laboratory at Caltech. And actually, Hoyle writes about this story in his autobiography, "Home Is Where the Wind Blows." It's a very nice book, and he tells this story. And he went and spoke to the nuclear guys that he was doing this work with, and asked them, "Well, do we know of any kind of resonance in the carbon nucleus?" And they spoke to some people who said, "Well, there had been kind of reports about it, but we can go in and we can take a look." And so they set up an experiment to do the test, and lo and behold, there was a resonance right where Hoyle predicted, which was really kind of cool, because here he had this process that depended upon building up elements over billions of years of cosmic time, and there was a constraint, there was a bottleneck created that was only solved by having this resonance in carbon that could create the extra carbon and oxygen that wound up making you and me. And it just, it's one of these little bizarre yin and yang type things where the symmetry of this big cosmic picture ties into the little microphysics that we can actually measure on Earth. And I thought that was a fascinating story. And so I started kind of accumulating stories like this that I found out in astronomy and cosmology, where some discovery in astronomy cues us into some discovery that measurement that we can actually do on the Earth. And sometimes it's a lot of years between the time we get and do the measurement in space and when we can do the measurement on the Earth. It takes time for the technology to develop sufficient precision to actually do the measurement.
All right, and we were saying also before the show, we were talking a bit about relativity and how we had experimented and verified relativity with gravitational lensing, and we saw light behind a solar eclipse, the starlight would come around, and
Right,
then
right.
we could test that later with high speeds in our particle accelerators.
The one of the things that in tracking down the history on some of this stuff is that when Einstein proposed general relativity in 1915, the only experiment that he had which matched up with it was the precession of Mercury, which was known since about 1859. So that was the only, actual experimental test that he had that gave him any kind of clue that maybe this theory is correct. It would be later that the deflection of starlight, where they would test it in eclipse in 1919. And they actually measured gravitational redshifts for white dwarf stars around 1924. And of course, cosmological redshifts were coming out in the 1920s, where basically the Hubble expansion was tied into an evolutionary cosmology model. But we did not do an Earth-based experiment of gravitational redshift until around 1959, 1960, where they did the actual experiment where they launched it. Basically, I think they fired a gamma ray up through a long tube and had it received by a crystal that could only receive it at a very, very finely tuned frequency. I believe it's called the Mossbauer effect, I believe is what the experiment was. But we didn't, it was, you look at it, 1960 from 1915, so you've got, what is that, 45 years between the time it was first proposed and all the measurements you could test it with were cosmological, till finally they could measure it on Earth. They would later in they would have tested the gravitational time dilation, the famous experiment of the guys taking the atomic clocks on the plane and such. And today this effect has to be integrated into the global positioning system, because otherwise, the system, you have to take into account the time things very precisely. I went to a talk by Neil Ashby one time where he talked about how I believe it was like 11 kilometers per day or something like that of error that accumulates if you do not include the general relativistic effects because of this.
So,
But this general relativity, it started out as cosmology.
So basically, are we verifying then that the laws of physics are applicable everywhere and they're the same in every place? Is that what these experiments are verifying for us?
They are giving us a lot of feedback that encourages that. Galileo in 1592 was one of the first people to propose the idea that the physics on Earth applies also in space. And a lot of these experiments indicate that, well, if you can measure certain things in space, you can also potentially measure effects of them on the Earth as well. So it's really kind of a fascinating topic. I've accumulated a number of little goodies of that. The theory of gravity is one of my favorite ones because that one goes back so far. But when in six when let's see when Newton originally proposed it in the 1600s, they didn't know the value of G. It would be about 100 years before they had a numerical value for G. The only places they could do measurements were measuring the motions of planets, but planets were these tiny little points moving through this vast empty space. And so, in a sense, you've got a theory with huge gaps here. You've got these spots where you're doing measurements where the planets move, but there's all this other space that you're not actually conducting measurements unless something passes through it. So if you want to talk about a theory with some serious gaps, look at the theory of gravity. In fact, I actually did some numbers one time out here. If you go out to the planet Pluto and you say, okay, well, the path that the planet sweeps out in its orbit by its size over the length of that orbit, and you add those all together, it turns out that it's that the planets sweep out about 1.7 times 10 to the minus 13th. So that's less than a trillionth, I believe, of the space is actually been measured for the theory of gravity. Yet we assume that, oh, it's true in that it's a spherically symmetric, GM over R squared force law.
Yeah, simple Newtonian law, yeah.
Yeah, and this is just out through the solar system. Imagine what it's like if you try to do the same calculation to the nearest star. That number gets even smaller. That theory of gravity has a lot of big gaps in it.
Yeah, and yet we can also see, correct, that the gravitational law still applies in the cosmos and on Earth. It applies everywhere.
Yeah, and of course we didn't actually get to launch spacecraft to actually measure in situ by piloting the spacecraft ourselves to until n the 1950s, 1957 or so. So it's really kind of interesting. I'm wondering whether anyone was debating, well, do we know how they're going to move? Can you imagine the controllers at NASA debating over this issue? Well, we don't really know how gravity works. We just see these planets here, and we're going to be traveling in the space in between the planets. So do we really know that these laws apply in that area? I don't think that debate happened, although I might be wrong.
So I'm sure you would agree then that it's reasonable to conclude that the laws of physics are going to be the same no matter where you are in the universe.
Yes, and while we can't say that it's absolute 100%, the trick is that we've done a lot of experiments that indicate that this is the case. We build technology, we build computers and stuff like that based on the assumption that every electron acts exactly the same way. We have how many? What fraction of electrons have we actually tested in the cosmos? A very small fraction.
So, how would you say this applies to creationism, and do they deny extrapolation in science? I mean, I would say that they deny extrapolation in science, but what would you say on creationism?
I would say they're the general tendency is to deny the extrapolations when it indicates something that they don't like, is my major point there. We have these things, science is full of these types of events throughout history, where theory and experimental capability are always kind of leapfrogging. Sometimes the theory is a little ahead of the experiment. Sometimes there are experiments that have results that we can't explain. In 1900, the top theories of the day were Newton's mechanics and Maxwell's electromagnetism. But when they tried to apply these to the structure of the atom, they got these things that collapsed in, microseconds. And if you want to talk about a crisis in science, now there's a crisis in science when all your best theories indicate the matter that's around you should be, self-destructing in a microsecond. That's a real crisis in science. Yet they and no one bought and. To my knowledge, no one jumped in and said, "Well, it must be divine intervention. It is, the atoms are held together by divine power, and so as a result, we don't need to ask any more questions." No, there was a bunch of really clever people that went and did some more experiments and proposed various ideas and and followed up on experiments until they finally got a consistent picture where today we've actually reached a point where we can computationally predict the structures of certain molecules. Computationally, it's very hard, unfortunately, because it's just a huge computational problem. But we have basically the physical structure to do this mathematically, that we know conceptually how to do it. It's just that computationally, in some cases, it takes a ridiculously long time or a ridiculously large amount of memory on your computer to do it. But it's an example of these types of cases where, yeah, science has, they run into these problems, and but science is about solving problems. They're about finding those solutions, and it's a case, the creationists like to complain, well, they have problems with naturalistic science, but I haven't been able to see anyone propose a non-naturalistic theory. I'm not sure what a non-naturalistic theory would look like. I mean, does that mean that, like, if I write the theory of gravity and, I have like a Christian and a non-Christian walk up to the edge of a building, if the Christian steps off, they won't be affected by gravity, but the non-Christian will? I don't know what this means. It makes no sense. My other favorite example is that someone says, well, God could have created instantaneously. And well, my response to that is, well, God could create a cell phone instant to just take a rock of the same size and turn it magically into a cell phone. But I don't see anyone making any business models out of that assumption of keeping their inventory populated. They have to learn how the physics works to make the components into the cell phone and have people manufacture these things using these nice little repetitive laws that enable them to build a cell phone. And God's not going to turn a rock into a cell phone and let someone operate their business, maintain their inventory on their cell phone store by that method. While creationists seem to think that the science out in the cosmos and deep in the past is something that's unrelated to our everyday, today existence, but it's not. It ties in, and it's really quite fascinating. The general relativity, as I said, today, not, I wonder how people would think if suddenly the GPS system wasn't around. People use it for like emergency rescue operations and stuff like that to depend very heavily on this. But potentially, if someone had said, "Oh, you can't believe relativity because that's some extrapolation off into space, so we shouldn't bother doing these Earth-based experiments that might test it," that raises that whole question too of if you believe something is true cosmologically, you were more inclined to test it on the Earth. Whereas some of these experiments, my guess is a creationist never would have done some of the experiments. 30 years ago, they were arguing that, they found about the deficit of neutrinos from the sun. And for a lot of years, they could not figure out where these neutrinos were going. Most of the detectors that were built could not pick up the quote missing neutrinos as part of the solar neutrino problem. And a lot of creationists jumped on this as, oh, it's evidence that fusion isn't taking place in the sun can't be billions of years old, et cetera, et cetera. And so the scientists just kept on working, and they found some possible ways in which it could explain the neutrino deficit, one of the cases being that the neutrino had mass. And they did progressively more and more. As they developed more and more precise detectors, they found various ways to test the idea. At one point, they were testing it where they would test the neutrino flux when the detector was facing the sun and compare it to the neutrino flux on the night when the detector was on the night side of the Earth and the neutrinos had to pass through the Earth. And they got a little bit more of the clue from that. They actually found evidence of neutrinos oscillating through the material effect. And until finally, just in the past, gosh, was it 5 or 10 years, they actually were able to do a completely Earth-based experiment where they had a neutrino source in one area and I think a few hundred miles away, a detector, and were able to detect the neutrino oscillations. Would creationists have done that experiment? Well, probably not. Of course, some people might argue that, well, what good is a neutrino? But, 100 years ago, people said the same thing about electrons. Let's see them get along without them today.
Mike, I have a question about repeatability and falsifiability in science and how that would apply to creationist models on the origins of the universe and the origin of life, etc. How would falsifiability and repeatability, which is normally in science, how would that apply to any kind of creationist model?
Well, like I said, I've done some of the stuff. Most of my work has been actively with Barry Setterfield's claims of a decaying speed of light, although I have got a few other little tidbits that I've worked with for other claims. The issue of falsifiability, I mean, one of the things I should probably say is that so far, a lot of the creationist models that I've encountered, they fail early on. There are very simple experiments in some cases. Sometimes they even put some of the stuff in their own theory that you look at it and you say, well, let me test it at this limit and this limit to see if I get values that are reason match up with some experiment you might know, and it doesn't. You run into this issue quite often. A lot of the stuff that I am doing right now, I'm relying on archival stuff that's in public data archives and stuff like that for testing, making tests of known data sets against some creationist models. And you can conduct a certain amount of experiments, and I haven't seen any cases where I need to conduct a new experiment. A lot of the creationist models, they explain only what the creationist initially claims they explain. And if you try to say, okay, well, in the case of sea decay, there's the case, okay, well, if the speed of light was higher in the past, you can make it cross the cosmos in 6,000 years. Okay, let's do that. Fine. What happens if you're looking at something that's not at the edge of the cosmos? Let's look at something closer in, but the speed of light is still changing. It's the case of if you have a photon emitted from from say a binary star, from the companion of a binary star, it's in a position in its orbit, and it emits a photon. You record the time that you receive that photon. And say the binary star has a real period of a year. And so a year later, that companion star is back in the same position and emits another photon in your direction. And you time it and you say, oh, okay. Well, in the year time that between the first photon was emitted, the second photon was emitted, the speed of light is now slower. So the second photon is traveling behind the first photon, and they're just steadily traveling slower and slower as they approach the Earth. So what happens at the Earth? Well, if the original star, the binary star had a period in its location of 1 year, at the Earth, it would appear to have a period longer than a year. So that's one thing you can do. But also, as you accumulate photons and watch them for multiple periods, you will see this period change. And there are very definitive predictions depending upon the form, how the speed of light changed in there. There's very definitive predictions that you can make on that, and the creationist claims just don't match up. In fact, the second edition of my Sea Decay, which I was talking about before, the second edition of it, which I'm trying to get the draft out, I've been able to include binary pulsars in this particular version of it. And the binary pulsars don't match up there. The previous one, I used the pulsar spin for doing this, what I call differential arrival time. That is, the photons, when they arrive at different times, in later times, have a different spacing than what they do with the original source, and you can make some measurements about how the speed of light, the signal speed, has changed based on those measurements. So, you know, you can do these kinds of experiments. There's lots of public data out there already available to do it. And I've been relying most heavily on that. I know a few people in the field, and so as a result, I know whose shoulders to tap on to usually for pointers, because I like to do public data, because one possibility is that this might be something that could be integrated into a classroom, and you want to make sure that students can freely get to the data, and it's nice to be able to have them be able to do things in class that use actual data. But it gives you a way to test things. And it's, the trick is to just outline what kind of tests you would do. And it's you know, you can, I don't know, I'm not sure what else I could say along those lines other than being able to some of the experiments you can do computationally, a lot of them. I wish there were some niftier ones. I can't answer for biology because I'm not a biologist. I mean, I studied it some when I was younger, but I haven't really been into it except for the little bit I gather by osmosis by following Talk Origins discussions and stuff like that. So, anyway.
And there was, I mean, if creationists are going to deny the applicability of physical law in every place, but if they do accept that, and let's use your sea decay for an example, won't the decay of the speed of light have other physical consequences that we should notice? I noticed in, like, for example, Maxwell's equations, he derives the speed of light and it's a constant there. Won't it have a physical effect on, say, the permeability of free space or other things like that?
Yeah, it's well, that's an example. And in fact, in Setterfield stuff, he usually tries to play around with other physical constants to try to make up for the difference. But even then, you start running into problems. The one that is most notable is in the case of, say, something like energy. Where you he ran into one problem where he has to have masses change, because he defines essentially two time scales. He says there's an atomic time scale that's keyed to atomic processes like spectral lines and nuclear processes and stuff like that, and that ran very fast in the past. And then he defines what he calls a dynamical time scale, which is based on gravitational phenomena. And he had to kind of lock it down that way with gravitational, because 2,000 years ago, the year was still 365 and a quarter days long. So he couldn't invoke a you know, over a 2,000-year time frame, he would have a hard time claiming that those time scales that actually change that quickly. But when you mix those two time scales, when you have phenomena that mix those two time scales, you start running into very significant problems. One of the things, I'll just kind of let this out, actually, one of the guy on the Talk Origins group put me onto this. One of the problems you run into very quickly, because he wanted to do the dynamical time scale, he wound up running into problems where, okay, well, he can't have E equals MC squared. If C increases, then that, you know, that blows up. You know, in the distant past, if C was higher, then, you know, energy processes are higher. So he makes mass change. So he makes the mass of the fundamental particles and all that stuff decrease inversely to C squared to exactly cancel it out. Well, that creates a problem with gravitational things. So he has to make G compensate, you know, go the other way to try and balance that out. The trick is, there's so many things that have gravitational time scales linked to the atomic time scales that depend upon the balance of forces that there's very simple tests. And my favorite one that someone at the Talk Origins news group directed me towards is the fact that if you have the planet and, you know, g times m is a constant, so that your orbital periods are right, that means your escape velocity of your planet stays the same. Well, that's really convenient. So, but what happens to the gas that makes up the atmosphere on the planet if the masses of your atoms were lower in the past? Well, assuming that, you know, Boltzmann's constant doesn't change, which he hasn't done, Setterfield hasn't done anything to indicate that it does, the average energy per particle stays about the same, k times t in the Boltzmann in these equations. So as a result, the average energy is the same, but the mass is smaller. What does that mean? It means the mean velocity is larger, and in some cases, much larger. In fact, so large it readily exceeds the Earth's escape velocity, and you find that about 3,000 years ago or so, the escape velocity, the mean molecular speed would have been so high that the Earth would not have been able to retain an atmosphere. So I call this section in my piece, "Did Adam and Eve Suffocate?" Because the Earth could not have retained an atmosphere under these conditions. And it's little things like that. A lot of people try to argue, well, stellar structure would be different. And I hope one day to maybe actually add a section on that derivation in my write-up, maybe for the third edition. But it just comes home much faster if you say, gee, 3,000 years ago, the Earth would not have been able to hold an atmosphere. That's something that you're pretty certain that wasn't true. You can always, hand wave and argue, oh, well, there's this other effect that you're not including, that could explain why the stars are still, exactly the same as we would see them if the speed of light was constant. But being able to bring it, right into your own backyard, in the historical past is a really great way to make a point. So I like finding examples where you, again, as I pointed out there, where you take the extrapolation from space and turn it back into what can you measure on the Earth.
Well, I think this is all we have for the interview. Are there any closing remarks you'd like to make about what we've been discussing?
Well, let's see. Just that astronomy is a field that deals with extremes. In astrophysical environments, we deal with extremes of density, both high and low, in neutron stars or empty space, in temperature, in accretion disks around black holes or the center of stars. And it provides some ready laboratories for testing some things that right now it's just not too safe to test on the Earth, or you just can't test on the Earth just because you don't have the technology to do it. And those are clues as to how the universe works. They provide just as important valid clues that we can use to learn more about how the universe works. And sometimes this stuff actually gets integrated in technology. And that is really important for the nation, for its economic competitiveness and its scientific competitiveness in the world. One thing that I have made a point of in some of my stuff is I don't regard it as a coincidence that the Einstein letter written in August of 1939 was written shortly after Beta had figured out how to do some of the nuclear reactions in stars. This was the first calculation that was done where they were able to demonstrate that the nuclear physics that we know on Earth would seem to work in explosive type environments of high density. And it may have been one of the key things that made the atomic bomb possible. However you feel about that, and some people would regard that as a negative. But it's fascinating some of the things that you uncover, the link ups. One of the things that I came across that I didn't think I would actually find was you use large-scale integrated circuits in computers that rely on quantum tunneling for how they operate, but also it turns out it creates a heating problem for them. But it's in our technology. But we didn't actually do a tunneling experiment. We weren't able to do a controlled tunneling experiment, electron tunneling experiment in a laboratory until the 1950s. Prior to that, tunneling was used to solve the whole issue of hydrogen, the proton-proton chain in stars for the nuclear reaction there. And prior to that, it had solved the mystery of how alpha decay worked. Another thing which ties into the age of the universe, because we use radioactive dating, of course, and alpha decay is one of the processes that we rely on heavily. So here's another case of something where cosmologically the phenomena of tunneling in quantum mechanics, just a few years discovered just in the 1920s, what made a difference in technology that people have sitting on their desk. Imagine how different it would be if someone said, oh no, that tunneling stuff can't be happening because it makes the universe old. Someone else would have eventually invented the transistor and the tunnel diode and large scale integrated circuitry and stuff like that. So anyway, I thank you very much.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for coming on to the show to talk with us about all this. I'm sure we'll have you on again to discuss some of the C-decay claims or plutonium halos when you get that a little more developed, because I remember talking with you before and you said you need to do a bit more work on that.
Yeah. Actually, and let me plug my website briefly. You can Google me under Dealing with Creationism in Astronomy. And that's my website, and it's at www oh, h I'm sorry, http colon slash slash homepage.mac.com/CygnusX1. That's all one string together. Cygnus X1 because that was my PhD dissertation topic.
Yeah, I
So
was
thank you.
just about to ask you about your website, but yeah, thanks for presenting it to us. And yeah, once again, thank you, Tom, for coming on the show. It's Bridgman, right?
Yes.
Had to make sure I got it right. So
Yes.
yeah, thank you for coming with us on the show, and we'll have to have you back some other time to discuss some various creationist claims. So
Well,
yes,
thank
thank
you.
you. Have a good night.
You too.
Bye. All right, everyone. Now that the interview is over, I'd like to let you all know I'm going to be on vacation in Chicago until the 26th of this month, so there will not be any podcast for next week, and most likely I won't do a new podcast until early July. So I want to let everyone know. In the meantime, if you have any questions, comments, concerns, just email me. My email is rlippens@wavecable.com, or you can post on the forum or in the blog. There's actually a section in the forum now for show ideas. There hasn't been much activity in the forums lately, but if you want to post there and help get it going, feel free. And I will get back to you when I return from my vacation. So until then, have a nice week, enjoy the summer, and we will talk next time.